Good morning. How you doing? I don't know if you heard or not, but this is kind of a special service we're doing today. The 9 o'clock service we did unplugged. The power went out about 8:45, and we did the whole first service without AC and all acoustic guitars up front. It looked like the Eagles tour, you know, with the three guys up there, and it was kind of like old-time religion hour, but we got through it. It was really fun. Then about a quarter before 11, the power came on. So this is a new experience for me. It's a new experience for me to be sharing with you today. My name is Jim. I'm serving here as the executive pastor, and I'm absolutely delighted to be able to share with you today, kind of as a first time. I also thank you for welcoming me into your community. You've made me feel really at home. And same is true for my wife and my kids as well. So it's a lot of fun. You remember when you left home for the first time? When you were out on your own, when your parents dropped you off, or that you left. I had that experience again last weekend. We have four sons. I took our third son off to school, took him up to K-State, and it's always weird to go back to the college town where you once were, even if it was briefly, because it's so familiar and it's so absolutely different. And then you think, how in the world could it be 33 years since I was dropped off at school? Because I'm so young. How could it be that long? You know, where does the time go? And when I returned home, we're there with my last son, who's a sophomore in high school. And it's a completely different kind of experience. And I'm thinking, when was the last time we only had one at home? It was 20 years ago. We were getting ready for the big boy bed, the move out of the crib. We were working on colors and letters and numbers and nap time and stuff like that. And now we're working on dorm contracts and college majors and budgeting and what are they going to do when they grow up? Still the same question, but with a little more pressure, as my oldest son is feeling on his last semester of college, and he's getting that question, what are you going to do? And he doesn't quite know the answer. Just like I didn't know that answer when I was in my senior year. 20 years ago, the future's wide open for me, parents, little kids. My kids are kind of just extensions of myself, you know. It's full of hope. It's fun. It's very physical and tactile and absolutely exhausting. And now, you know, I'm not quite as physically needed, but I'm needed yet still in the same way. And I had this feeling and this thought, like when you drop your kid off at school, like where did the last 18 years go? How could this have happened just like that? And then you start to feel like, did I give him everything I thought I should have given him? You know, maybe I should have paid a little bit more attention here, but a little bit more intentional. And sure, there's some things, and it's very exciting to be able to drop a kid off at school and know they're going to be okay. I've launched them in a sense. But there's that other sense that I have of like, if I could have been a parent of that young kid, now I know so much more. Like when I became a dad, I didn't have all my stuff together. You know, I didn't know what I know now. I was growing up too in the midst of that. It's hard. What do you remember about that time that you left home? About that time you were separated? I thought, what were the feelings that were going through your mind? Yeah, I look at my son, I'm dropping him off at the freshman dorm. He's excited. He's got his roommate that he likes. He's studying something that he really wants. He's so glad to be out of high school. I mean, it's all, the world is before him. You know, mom keeps asking for another hug. Okay, sorry, you know, and we're all getting emotional and stuff. And he's just like, okay, I'm ready, you know, I'm ready to get out there. Do you remember what it was like for you when you got dropped off? Or when you left? I'd love to hear some thoughts. Anything come to mind, either as a parent or for you as a kid, when you left home? Yeah.
Like into a bird jumping out of a nest where you know it's time to mature.
Uh-huh.
You know it's time to go. The unbelievable fear of falling.
Yeah. So he said he likens it to like when a bird first has to leave the nest and you know it's time. But that's absolutely frightening because you're just going to end up, you know, are you going to land okay? Are you going to fall? Or what's going to happen? How about the rest of you? Any other thoughts? come to mind about that transition? Yeah, right here. I was like, see you later. Yeah. And there's sometimes as parents, they feel that way too. Like, okay, Mr. I know everything. Yeah. Not that I've ever done that, but I know some people who do that.
I remember I thought I could finally eat whatever I
wanted. Mike realized he could finally eat whatever he wanted without Mom. That's where the freshman 15 started, right there. Well, today I'm going to finish up this sermon series that we've been doing as a pastoral leadership team in 2 Samuel 7. Tim started us off here a few weeks ago at a place of transition, and it's a place of transition like it was for me in my life last weekend. And it says this: after the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all of his enemies around him, he said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I am, living in a house of cedar, while the ark of God remains in a tent." And after that kind of comes this passage that we've been exploring and stuff, where first Nathan says, okay, David, you're great. You go ahead and whatever you set your mind to, you do it. But then later, Nathan hears from the Lord and he kind of changes his tune. He says, you know, I think the Lord is saying to you, I didn't ask you to do that. And then Isaac last week reminded us of God reminding David through Nathan, remember when I took you out of the pasture? Remember, first and foremost, I'm your shepherd. You're mine. I don't need you to do this thing for me. And we come to this passage that I am going to kind of look at today. And it goes like this. Nathan says this: the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Here's this promise that Nathan puts forth, and he makes it clear that it isn't David who's supposed to build the temple for the Ark of the Covenant, that it's for his ancestors. And sometimes it's really good for us to hear a word from the Lord that is just like that. Hey, here's something you don't need to do. Because so often we get kind of caught up in things that we think we need to do for God's sake, but they really aren't for us to do. And David has the luxury of hearing, hey, don't do this. And there's a promise. The promise is simple and it's twofold. The promise is, I will build the temple. I will do it through your offspring. And secondly, it is a much longer view. And someone from your line will always sit on my throne. And it brings this question for me when I first read it, like, which would be harder to do? Would it be harder to actually build the temple? Or would it be harder to raise a people that could build a temple? Which would be more difficult? And David, most likely, he could have pushed on, he could have built the temple, but God wasn't asking him to do it. He was asking him to do it through his offspring. And you have to realize that this is something then that David might not ever see. He might not see it come to pass. In fact, he might be long gone before the temple is ever built. One is a fairly straightforward task. Go build the temple, and when the temple's done, you could look around and go, hey, see that temple? Did it. I did that. But when you're asked to have your offspring do something, it's a little bit harder to go, did that. It's kind of messy. It's kind of like a circuitous route. You have hopes. You know, when I drop my kid off at college, I think, yeah, I hope I've made you ready for this stage of your life. I hope so. But there's a little bit of like, it's kind of up to you. I'll be there, but it's kind of an unknown. So I got thinking about this. I got thinking about ancestors that go before me and offspring. And I was thinking about my own ancestry. And I have a couple pictures I want to share with you. The first one is my great-grandparents, Aaron Gilbert Gumm. This is taken sometime around the turn of the last century, around 1900. His wife, Margaret Rebecca Sullivan Gum, my only Irish ancestor. I think sometimes I wish their surnames would have been reversed, so I could have been a Sullivan and drinking the green beer and, hey, I'm Irish and all that stuff, but I'm Gum, you know, and that's just the way it is. And so my grandfather Gum was the second of six children. They lived in West Virginia. My grandmother Gum lived a few mountain hills over, and here's their family. This is a banner day, picture taken 1899. Look at this group. Oh my gosh. All the men with a rifle in one hand and a rabbit in the other. My grandmother Gum is in the fourth woman over from the left there. She's 16 years old, little bow tied. That's Grandma Gum. She lived to be 93. Some people ask me, am I Irish? Am I German? Am I English? Oh no, second generation hillbilly. Absolutely second generation hillbilly. And it got me thinking, I think Isaac and I are very close relatives. I really do. So Arbert and Margaret got together, and here's their family, 1925, little family portrait. Part of the all-name team there, Harold, Madeline, Grace, Basil, Rose, and Janet. My dad was either in the womb or to be born the next year, Robert. I don't know where he got that name. But seven kids when his mom was 43. There's that family together there. I didn't see this picture for a long time. I want to show you a picture of my dad. This is the day he was a celebrity, 1945. Wilbur Wright High School, class of 1944. He didn't see his graduation day, left early, joined the service, fought in the Battle of the Bulge, came back in June of 1945, the first soldier back after VE Day. The newspaper man met him off the boat in New York City. This is one of the pictures that was in the spread. There he is with his mom, who at that time was 62. She wondered if she'd ever see her boy again. She's glad to have him home. He would leave the next week, head onto the West Coast and onto the Philippines, get ready for the land invasion of Japan that never happened. Well, that's a little bit of my history, my background, my story. That's how I got to this point. And what was interesting, as we were doing this daily office this week, we came to this passage that was kind of the fruition of where we started 6 weeks ago in the daily office with this passage in 2 Samuel 7. It goes like this. In 1 Kings chapter 8, it said, "The priest then brought the ark of the Lord's covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, and put it beneath the wings of the cherubim. And when the priest withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because of this cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled his temple. Then Solomon said, 'The Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever.'" Solomon goes on, "While the whole assembly of Israel was standing there, the king turned around and blessed them, and he said, 'Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his own hand has fulfilled what he promised with his own mouth to my father David. For he said, since the day I brought my people out of Egypt, I have not chosen a city in any tribe of Israel to have a temple built so that my name might be there. But I have chosen David to rule my people Israel.'" And then it says this, "My father David had it in his heart to build a temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, 'You did well to have it in your heart to build a temple for my name. Nevertheless, you are not the one to build the temple, but your son, your own flesh and blood. He is the one who will build a temple for my name.'" The Lord has kept the promise he made. I have succeeded David, my father, and now I sit on the throne of Israel, just as the Lord promised, and I have built the temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. I have provided a place there for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our ancestors when he brought them out of Egypt. There it is. It's fulfilled. The promise that we talked about 3 weeks ago, that we read about 6 weeks ago, the promise is fulfilled. And so that is that the end of the story? David's offspring does it. I mean, it's an amazing event. They put the Ark of the Covenant in there. It fills with the glory of the Lord. Solomon is king. He blesses the people. He says, look what God has done. This place is magnificent. So is that the story? Is that the end of the sermon? And I think there's parts of my story, too. I was thinking about that, the things that I didn't tell you about my coming to be, my ancestors. You know, my grandpa Gum, Arbert, I never knew that name until I was in my later 30s. I never saw that picture of my dad's family until I was in my 40s. I only heard one story as a young child about my dad, and it was this. My dad said of his father, I never knew my dad. You know, I never had a dad. My dad left when I was 7 years old. The year was 1933 when my dad was 7 years old. It was the height of the Depression. My grandfather was a carpenter and he couldn't find work. And he started to just break down. At first he left the family. But he left the family in a very unusual way. He decided to build a one-room cabin on the corner of their property. He said he built a cabin West Virginia style. He took four stones and he placed them in the corners and he built a log cabin. And that's where he lived, right there on the same land where the rest of his family lived. He was estranged but yet present. My dad's memory of him was that he was scared of him. And then finally, and this story I heard only late in my father's life, and I heard it also from my cousin, that one night, I don't know if it was after a long night of drinking or something, but my grandfather had it, that he'd got a shotgun and he was going to kill the whole family. You don't hear that story as a little kid. Grandpa left. He moved to Miami. He remarried. And my dad never saw him again. It was when my dad was at boot camp in 1944, they got this telegram from his oldest brother, Harold. Pretty matter of fact. And it just said, your dad passed away. Omit flowers. He was cremated, and supposedly his ashes were scattered under an orange tree somewhere in Miami. I think about that story. It's surprising. Something I didn't know about. I think about the things I didn't know about my dad. What he meant when he said I never had a dad. That he was from a completely broken home. You know, what? How did I know my dad? I knew my dad as always being there, supporting us, being able to take care of us, supporting me in all my stuff, paying my way through school, loving us. I didn't realize the depth of how he was changing his family's story, how different it was for me than it was for him. Well, what about Solomon? How did it go from David to Solomon? Was it just smooth sailing? It wasn't. It was kind of messy, like my family was messy. See, one day David was on the roof of his palace and he was looking out and he saw this woman bathing and she was very beautiful. And he decided, since he was king, that he wanted to have that woman, and he did. And so he had people send for her, and her name was Bathsheba. He slept with her, and she later on went back to her home, and she sent message to David and basically said, I'm pregnant. Well, David was now in a predicament because Bathsheba was a married woman. In fact, her husband was a soldier in David's army. So David thinks how to get himself out of this, and he calls for Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, to come home, hoping that he'll sleep with his wife. But he doesn't. He's a good soldier, and good soldiers don't sleep with their wives during battle, during wartime. So he takes Uriah in another night. He gets him drunk, hoping that maybe Uriah will lose his scruples a little bit or sensibility and sleep with his wife. Uriah sleeps outside, doesn't sleep with his wife again. David comes up with another plan. He decides to tell his commanders, put Uriah in the heat of battle. Put him in the very midst of it. And then when the fighting is very fierce, withdraw from him. And that's what happened. And Uriah was killed in battle. After a period of mourning for Bathsheba, David took her as his wife. This was David and Bathsheba's family secret. And it was later that the prophet Nathan came and confronted David. A different story than this time. It's a different one than, hey, it's not for you to build the temple and your offspring are going to build the temple and they're going to reign on the throne forever. He said, David, there was once a rich man who had all sorts of flocks and animals and stuff, and then there was a poor man who only had a ewe, and the rich man came and he took the little ewe of the poor man. And David goes, oh, it's terrible. And Nathan confronts me, says, you're that man. Nathan brings a message to David that cuts him to the heart, and he realizes he's absolutely guilty of adultery and murder. Nathan exposes David's brokenness, the brokenness of his story. Soon afterward, Bathsheba did give birth, and later the son became ill and died. And this is what the scripture said. And David comforted his wife Bathsheba, and he went to her and he made love to her. And she gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon. And the Lord loved him. And because the Lord loved him, he sent a word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah. Jedidiah means that, loved by the Lord. Nathan comes with another message. It's different than the first message that you are a broken man, David. It's that this child is loved, and it's a message that's one of promise and hope. So we see in this text, it's both there, it's all together. In David's life, there's this brokenness, even the man after God's own heart, but there's also this promise that great things are going to happen through him and through his line, and it does through Solomon. Frederick Buechner says it so well in his book, Telling Secrets. And he says it this way. I've come to believe that by and large, the human family all has the same secrets, which are both very telling and very important to tell. They are telling in the sense that they tell what is perhaps the central paradox of our condition. That what we hunger for, perhaps more than anything else, is to be known in our full humanness, and yet that is often just what we most fear more than anything else. It's important to tell, at least from time to time, the secret of who we truly and fully are, even if we tell it only to ourselves, because otherwise we run the risk of losing track of who we truly and fully are, and little by little, come to accept instead the highly edited version which we put forth and hope that the world will find it more acceptable than the real thing. It's important to tell our secrets too, because it makes it easier that way to see where we've been in our lives and where we're going. And it also makes it easier for other people to tell us a secret or two of their own. And exchanges like that have a lot to do about what being in a family is all about, what being human is all about. It's all in there together. I'm thankful that we have the scriptures that has the messiness and the promise all together, that it's not edited out, that it's not hidden. That brokenness that was there in my dad's family, and there's brokenness in my own family, there's brokenness in myself, and David's brokenness is our brokenness. And yet, just as my dad had promised for me, I had promised for my kids, that David's promise also is our promise. And if I think about my own story and how I happen to actually be right here today doing this type of work in this community, I'm kind of shocked. You wouldn't look at my past and see it coming, perchance. And I know there's been times in my not too distant past where I didn't know if I could hold myself together, let alone hold my family together. That there were times when the person that I least wanted to be with happened to be me. That I was just aware of how much I needed God and how short I fell. And yet I believe God has a promise for me. I believe God has a promise for you to be fulfilled. That he has hopes for you as a person, or you and your wife as a couple, or you and your family, you and your workplace, us as a body. The story is not yet done. Julian Norwich says it this way: first the fall, then the recovery from the fall, and both are the mercy of God. First the fall, then the recovery from the fall, and both are the mercy of God. You see, sometimes we kind of get it wrong. We think it's an either or. It's either promise or brokenness. And so in our life, you know, we start following the Lord, and then we get shocked that some things in our life come up, or there's some messiness, or some times that stuff just happens and there's brokenness that re-enters our life, or that we're surprised about it. Other times we get so overwhelmed by that story of brokenness that we think that's the end of the story. That's it. I'm unfit. No future for me here. But it's never either or. It's always both and. It's both the fall and the recovery of the fall. Our lives are always usable by God. We need not always be effective, but only transparent and vulnerable. Then we're instruments, no matter what we do. Silence, inaction, is the ability to trust that God is acting, teaching, and using me even before I perform or after my seeming failures. That's what Richard Rohr said. Our lives are always usable by God. And if you think about Solomon's life, and that was the golden age, but even later, you know, those kingdoms fell, those peoples were taken off into exile. There was a period when no one sat on the throne. That eventually, though, there is a promise in that, in the coming of Jesus, the one who will sit on the throne forever. There is that promise for people as well as an individual. And so I come back to that question I started with: which is more difficult, to build a temple or to build a people that can build a temple? And the reality is, it's much more difficult to build a people to build a temple. Life is untidy. It's kind of messy. So I think for us as a group of people, you know, we have our stuff, and we're gathered together. Thank goodness we're gathered together. But the reality is that I will hurt some of you, and you will hurt me, and we will hurt each other. But we're going to stay in this promise together, that it's both and, the brokenness and the promise. And as a group, as a community, we think about this place even, this church building that we inhabit weekly. There was a group of people 80 years ago that gathered here and that were full of promise, and then it kind of fell apart. And then we've, in a sense, are part of fulfilling this promise that goes beyond that group of people, that God's kingdom is much greater than we can even imagine. His purposes will will happen. He has a hope for us. So today, we have this opportunity as a community to come and take communion. This perfect picture of both brokenness and promise. That when you break the bread, you realize that Jesus' body was broken for us. And our brokenness becomes his brokenness. And that when we dip it into the cup, the promise of the new covenant, that his promise becomes our promise. The game's never over. And it's always there mixed together. We just don't take one of the elements. We always take them both because we've got to remember that's both part of it. Let's pray.